And it's Common Science with Jeff Danner. He of the Common Science blog on our website, chapelboro.com. It updates every Sunday. He joins us every Monday to talk about it, except this week when he joins us on Thursday. How you doing?
I couldn't make it here on Monday, but actually, just over the last couple of minutes, I'm thinking, I've got the inspiration for perhaps a new column. Aaron and I often talk, I wish there was a camera in here. Sometimes Aaron says, because you can watch me sort of gesticulating wildly as I'm telling my science stories. But I think we need a camera just to watch Aaron's movements as he works all of the buttons and dials and answers the phone and puts on the headphones and coordinates everything that goes on the radio.
It is a delicate and beautiful dance.
No, I was just thinking, it is, absolutely, and you do it quite well. I was thinking, people say that, sort of good mental activity kind of keeps the mind fresh, like crossword puzzles or Scrabble. So perhaps, being a radio host really helps get, it occurs to me I could ask Ron this question.
You could. His mind's pretty sharp as far as I know, so I think he's doing pretty well. And we don't ever see this when you're listening on the radio, but we've got this whole big soundboard in front of me with I don't know how many, 14 different dials and buttons that need to be pressed.
Yeah, it looks like an old control panel from an airplane from 1978.
Yeah.
Although then over in the corners, anyway, I'm getting us off track. We're supposed to talk about
my column.
We got
two computers here. No, I'm all fine with talking about my delicate and beautiful dance, but so rarely do I get a chance to talk about my grace and
enjoy
beauty. All right, let's talk about the column. So last week we were talking about part one of this two-part series?
Two-part series.
On the local food, local food web, that was what it was called, and this is part two. So refresh our memories about part one.
Yeah, so part one I just talked about how we really do have some really great farmers and local shops and restaurants that are committed to local foods, and there's all sorts of advantages to that for us in terms of just having fresh, nutritious food and reducing our environmental footprint because we don't have to ship in as much food from
and this is the
far
food web,
distance.
So grown here, consumed here, everything
all that
local.
Works. And so last week I talked about the tremendous benefits if we could put together a local system for bread, all the way from growing wheat to making the loaves, and how, when you take fresh wheat, grind it, and turn it into bread and leave all the bran and the germ in there, you have this actually is really a nutritious food as opposed to what we tend to think of bread as being sort of an empty starch these days. And then part two I talked about, or not part two, but the second suggestion from last week is that we look at finding a way to preserve some of our local produce here that's not eaten right off the harvest through fermentation, which is a low energy way of preserving food, but it also makes the food more nutritious in that it like yogurt, is a live culture food with a variety of beneficial bacteria that are living in there that make it healthy for us. And as we've talked about in previous columns and radio discussions, there's a growing body of research that the removal of those live culture foods from our from our palate is harming our health in ending up giving us more allergies, more asthma. It's a similar function, as we've talked about in the past, about the overuse of antibiotics, which is another way of sort of removing healthy bacteria from the body. And so last week was all about bread and fermentation.
Right. And when we're talking about fermentation, a lot of times we think about beer, alcohol, but also yogurt and cheese and kind of pickling vegetables, fermenting vegetables, meats too, I think we were maybe not
meats,
so much.
Meats are a bit trickier, but a vegetable, you can put almost any vegetable matter in a solution, a diluted solution. Thank you. Salt water, and the bacteria that's already on the vegetable when you start will set off a process of fermentation. There'll be a change in the population of the bacteria in that fermenting vessel over time, and you end up with this class of bacteria that are they make the environment acidic. So they sort of crowd out any other bacteria, including potentially pathogenic bacteria, and then you're left with this food that is also shelf stable because of that acidity.
So it can stay. You can hang on to it for a long time.
Yeah, if you think about when people had root cellars and just a cool dark place, you can leave some sauerkraut in there for quite a long time.
Okay.
And as I mentioned last week, I'm only a few weeks away from, I made my first batch of sauerkraut over the summer.
Okay. Have you tried it yet?
No.
I feel like sauerkraut is a delicate and risky thing to do.
Well, see, my parents, who are probably listening, are coming down for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And so I intend to...
do they know this yet?
Well, they do now. I intend to sample my sauerkraut over the Thanksgiving holiday.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see how that goes.
This is the phone's ringing right now from your parents saying, oh man, something has just come
yes,
up.
Yes, we can't make it down for Thanksgiving.
I'm so sorry, but we have to not eat sauerkraut somewhere else. But that's gonna be really cool. Okay, so that was part one. So what is part two?
So part two, I've got two more suggestions and then sort of a little dream of mine at the end. And so another way in which I think we can improve our local food web is in beer. Mm-hmm. I have a particular affinity for beer, and we have some great local breweries that are growing up all the time. But even though those breweries are local, their ingredients come from far away.
Okay.
You know, a traditional and pure beer by the German law, which has a really great German name that I should remember, but just barley, hops, I'm blanking, yeast and water.
Okay, yes.
I almost had my Rick Perry oops moment there. And
barley, hops, and a third thing.
So barley, hops, yeast, and water. And most of the hops and barley that are used for brewing in the United States are grown in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, you know, if you go back several decades, five, six decades ago, hops were grown in the East, particularly in New York, but also down in the mountains of North Carolina. And then, as often is the case with, you know, other agricultural products or even natural plants, sort of this disease came in. We got downy mildew. And downy mildew thrives in sort of warm, moist environments, clay soils, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now it's very difficult to grow hops here. And I know that personally because I keep trying. you know, as we've talked about before, I have a little farm west of Carrboro, and I have been trying for the last 6 years to grow hops.
Okay.
And each and every year, I try to make some adjustments, and I do some research. And if you're not familiar with a hop vine, you grow them on very tall trellises. They can grow to be 12, 15 feet tall, this long, twirling vine.
And you could do it in North Carolina. We've got the climate for it. It's just mildew.
They grow, and then the hop flowers look like sort of mini green pine cones.
Okay. Okay.
Off the vine, they come up in about June, and they should mature in about August, and you can kind of see they turn kind of yellowish orange coming through, and that's when they're ready. Well, so every year for me at least, and I think for other growers in North Carolina, around July, you start to see the leaves turn brown, you see this white
stuff
on
it,
and the vine lives for a little while, but you can see the hop flowers turn brown and nothing happens.
It just doesn't work. Okay.
And this is sort of a shame in that, first of all, you don't want to have to bring ingredients from far away, but hops are actually a very good crop on a dollar of profit. Profit? Boy, I can't speak today. A dollar of
this
profit.
This is what happens when you come in at the end of the week instead of the beginning of
the
week.
I know,
I'm
better
on Mondays.
You're
refreshed and ready. Yeah. You're rare. Most people are just dragging on Monday, and by Thursday,
I'm a Monday guy. So the profit per acre for hops is quite high.
Okay.
And so it would be a boon for North Carolina farmers if we could solve this problem. And in fact, there are many groups trying to do that. And I've been following, there's NC State is partnering with some groups out in the mountains of North Carolina to try to introduce new strains of hops that will grow here. So we'll never it's unlikely that we'll be growing hops in Orange County.
Is there a way to get rid of, I guess if there was, then people would be doing it.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a simple way to do it. I mean,
okay.
I've read a million of these little things, like spray it with vinegar solution and, you know, a number of suggestions that might work even for a small-scale person like me with just a little plot. But there seems to be no
practical... But to make an industry out of it, you couldn't do it.
...industrial way of doing it, which is the same. So hopefully... you know, we'll be able to grow hops in the mountains of North Carolina, and we could grow barley for beer brewing here in Orange County. And so we could bring those ingredients home and have sort of a even more local beer. And if you travel in Europe, particularly in Germany or the Czech Republic, I mean, each town has its own sort of special blend of beer, which is great for marketing.
Yeah,
because you've got your sort of your local flavors from what barley
and it
grows
literally
there,
is
hops.
Local flavor. It's not just
So Here, I think on my suggestions from last week, or at least suggestions one and two on the bread and the fermentation, those were completely under our control. This one's a little more aspirational. Mm-hmm. If we could grow hops here.
Okay. But at least we can grow hops in North Carolina somewhere.
Yeah. 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 We should be closer than me. Most of them come from Oregon and Washington.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It'd be nice if we could have North Carolina.
So that
hops.
Would be good.
And there are people that are working on that.
Okay. So that's number one. Number two is.
So the second suggestion, and this one is a more fun one. As I mentioned in the column, I could have written an entire column on this or a series of columns. So it's all about raw milk and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And so raw milk means unpasteurized milk. So let's take a step back and talk about, you know, why is milk pasteurized?
Right.
When do we start doing that? So milk, if you're a bacteria, good bacteria, bad bacteria, whatever, if you're a bacteria, so imagine you're a bacteria. Are you there?
Yes, I'm done. I'm there.
Right. So there's about no better place for you to go than milk. You've got your water, you've got some, you know, sugars, you've got fats. It's a good environment. So you can prosper and grow there. But milk itself, when it comes out of the cow, raw milk, tends not to have any pathogenic bacteria. But people got sick in the 1800s in the big cities in Europe from milk quite frequently because someone working in the dairy was sick. They had a bacterial infection. They had diphtheria or TB or typhoid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they infected a large batch of milk, and then people would drink the milk, and they would all get typhoid or whatever
right.
that dairy worker had. And so that was, you know, the response to that was pasteurization by Louis Pasteur, who's a Frenchman.
Yes.
And pasteurization is
also a vaccine for rabies. I read that when I was six.
it's just a heat treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So the heat treatment kills any pathogenic bacteria, but it kills any other bacteria as well. So as we talked about before, I mean, there's a certain, I think, legitimate view that milk as a live culture food with the bacteria that comes with it from the cow is a healthy part of our diet.
Right.
And so there's that group of people that says, hey, we should consider raw milk. And then the logic behind that is we know how to handle hygiene in the dairy, mm-hmm. and we have workers have masks and gloves, and that it's no longer necessary to do this.
Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Well,
we do have the occasional contamination in the food industry.
We do, which we could go off on that tangent for a long time.
Yeah.
but on the milk front, there are two really interesting points. I hope we have time for. So,
I want to get. We got to get to your little dream here.
Right,
too,
sorry. So, the two interesting points are in Europe, where pasteurization was invented. Actually, they sell quite a bit of raw milk.
Yes, they do.
Which is very suggestive that it can be. You know, I
think
that's very strong.
And they seem to have a big problem with it, right?
That they do it well.
Yeah.
And the other really interesting thing, and this is where I think this becomes an interesting political story, is that if you're a small dairy farmer here in Orange County or North Carolina, you could increase your profit from your milk if you could sell raw milk to a consumer mm-hmm. or to a local store. But that's generally banned in the United States. So you have to sell it and it's not economically effective for you to have your own pasteurization equipment.
Okay.
So local farmers sell it to some bigger company that does the pasteurization. And so because of that middleman,
The local farmer makes less profit.
And so this is a really great, I mean, I wish the North Carolina legislature had to grapple with this because mm-hmm. I think it shines a really interesting light, because what does supporting farmers and agriculture mean, right? Because the big companies that have the money to do the pasteurization are better positioned and more likely to make large political donations.
Yes.
But the local farmers here in Orange County and around the state, you know, I think if we could develop a system of delivering safe raw milk and raw cheese comes in with that. Mm-hmm. Let's skip that.
It's maybe another example of the political ads that always have the pictures of the small farmers with their, you know, one guy on a tractor, and then when it actually comes to brass tacks, they're always supporting the agriculture industry more than the small farmer.
Yeah, it's a very common theme in many agricultural disputes, and oftentimes couched under the area of safety. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, again, it's a situation in this week, it's not totally within our control in Orange County to change the rules. I mean, there are laws against raw milk,
right.
But at least we could, you know, try to keep pressing the conversation and say, hey, look, they do it in Europe. Our farmers can make more money. Let's consider this.
So that's beer. That's raw milk and cheese.
Yeah.
What is your dream?
So, you know, I write these columns, and I think a lot of the ideas that I write about are very interesting, and I'd like to pursue them. And as I mentioned in the column, I wish I was independently wealthy and I could try a lot of them. But if I had the money, I mean, I think this would be a great thing to set up here in Orange County. Mm-hmm. And what I say in the column would be a two-location dream. There'd be a restaurant that would serve these kind of foods, and a processing facility that would brew the beer, make the cheese, do the fermentation of the vegetables. And then I'd have a restaurant, and I said, probably in Carrboro. It seems very Carrboro-esque. No offense to my Chapel Hillian friends, but where you would come in and all of those healthy local foods would be served. Mm-hmm. You'd come in and you'd get bread from the bakery and beer from my local ingredients and cheese from the cheese factory and fermented vegetables. And then I said for the main dish, and this is, as I mentioned in the column, which probably bring me down.
Yeah.
We talked about this a little bit last week, but cooked foods have a number of advantages for people. It's you're more effective in digesting the food and gathering nutrition if they're cooked. And so a great cooked food that tends to be looked down upon a lot is like a stew or a soup where you put in lots and lots of, you put a variety of ingredients, which is good for you in general.
Right.
Cook it in the broth.
And just one a day, right?
But just one a day. So you come to Jeff's little Carbro restaurant, which has the word ferment in the title. And you sit down and you get the stew of the day.
That's your
you
downfall bread, right there.
Yeah. Hey, you know,
Jeff's house of fermentation is probably not the best.
Well, you know, that's why a successful business venture needs lots of people who think in different ways, and I'm stuck in my engineering mindset, so I'm open to.
I will take full credit for this because I'm not independently wealthy either. But there is an establishment in on the outskirts of Carrboro. That's called the Honeysuckle Tea House that might actually be perfect for this.
Oh, I'm not familiar with
the
Honeysuckle.
Do you not know the Honeysuckle Tea House? Okay, all of you not know the Honeysuckle Tea House, if you're listening out there, get online and just look it up. It's way out. It's this, Tim Tobin runs it, who used to run Greenbridge. He opened this up. It's this beautiful place. It's on a farm. It's kind of outdoorsy, and it's gorgeous. They've got tea. They've got little pastries and things, and it's beautiful, and it's great. And that might be, I mean, it might already be an existing establishment that would be open to it. It's a tea house primarily, so it's not, it wouldn't be like a restaurant that you would go and, like, you'd take a whole family there and then everyone has to eat the same thing. You go there and maybe have that for lunch or something.
Well, I'll go check it out.
I don't know. Might be worth looking at. Tim, if you're listening, get in touch with Jeff.
Yep. Send me an email, commonscience@chapelboro.com.
Make it happen. All right. So that's the column for this week, and you can check it out online on our website, chapelboro.com. It's still there at the homepage. What's up for next week?
So always just a big change from week to week, but I've been reading a lot of articles about the possibility or probability that that sunscreens that are coming off our bodies and getting into the ocean are harming the coral.
Okay.
And I saw a couple of headlines, and I said, well, let me check that out. And as often is the case when that happens, I found a little surprise, so I'll be publishing an article about that on Sunday.
All right, sounds good. Common Science, Jeff Danner, we'll look for you on Monday of next week, right?
I'll be here on Monday.
All right, thank you so much.